Dr. Naomi Schimmel is the head of Lower School at Sheffer School, which to my knowledge, and Naomi, you can correct me if I'm wrong, is the only Jewish day school in North America that specifically serves students with language-based learning disabilities. She has over 10 years of experience working with children at a variety of levels and in different settings. Dr. Schimmel received her BA from the George Washington University and her master's in special ed from Hunter. She earned her doctorate in curriculum and teaching from Fordham University. Dr. Schimmel began her career as a classroom teacher at the Churchill School, teaching second and fourth graders. And most recently, she was a learning specialist at Riverdale Country School, where she provided differentiated instruction for students, implemented assessment models, and designed curriculum. Dr. Schimmel has supported teachers in enhancing their literacy instruction and created professional development workshops for her colleagues. She's also taught a graduate course in the Childhood Education Program at Fordham. So we are so happy to have you, Naomi, and what I'm going to do is just transfer the controls over to you.
Great. Thank you, Sarah, so much. And you are right. The Sheffer School is the only Jewish day school in the country for students with language-based learning disabilities. So it's very excited, and we're it's really very exciting, and we're located in Hammond, if anybody wants to look us up and find out more information. Today, as you all know, we're really going to be focusing on how to support young students as they learn to read. And we as school teachers and school educators learn a lot about how to teach students actually how to read. We focus a lot on teaching comprehension skills, reading skills, in addition to everything else that we do in school. And tonight's focus is really going to be about the early readers. And so what happens in babies and preschoolers and kindergarteners really before the real conventional reading and writing learning skills really develop. We're also going to look at how the brain reads and some of the key components that are necessary for the successful and fluent reading that we need in elementary school. And of course, we'll talk about some practical strategies as well and how to provide support for students both at home and in school. So the goals for today are to look at reading as a progression of stages, to understand the necessary components of reading. There's a lot of them, so we're going to go through a few of them. Identify some of the prerequisite skills that these young children should have before formal reading instruction begins, and learn strategies to enhance early literacy skills. As we get started here, I'd love to know a little bit about who is sort of in the room with me. This is the piece about being virtual that I can't see you and you can't see me. So I would love to know if you can just write in the chat box a little bit. What do you teach? What age students you're working with, if you're a parent or a teacher? And if you have sort of a goal that you're hoping to get out of the session as well, please just add it to the chat box. And as Sarah said earlier, I'm happy to answer questions along the way. So please do just fill that into the chat box if you can. I don't see any yet, but please feel free to just add them in as I continue. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the context of why this is all so important. Reading is really quite important, and it's really necessary for everything that we do. Let's just see if I can open these chats here. Okay. There we go. So reading is really important for everything that we're doing. You know, it's important in school. It's important when we order food off of a menu. It is important, especially when looking at parking signs. I live in Manhattan, and we always joke that you need a PhD in order to read any of the parking signs, as you can see from right here. I don't know if you're allowed to park here or not, but it's really quite confusing. So reading is everywhere, and the tricky thing about reading is that it's really not something that is natural. We are not hardwired for reading or writing. We are actually hardwired for speaking and language. It's something that is very unique to humans that we are actually wired to do, and that's quite natural for us. When we do speak, we automatically co-articulate our sounds. And so that really means that we compress the sounds of speech together so that our language sounds seamless and it's difficult to separate the sounds. And that happens naturally as we speak. And that then, though, makes it difficult for students, for young children to begin to learn to read when all of the speech sounds really blend together. So one of the tasks in early reading and writing skills is to really break that down for students and with students is where those speech sounds turn into distinct letter sounds on the page, different sounds, and also even different words. So we've been speaking for thousands of years, but writing is really quite recent. And I think that that's why it also gets so much attention here. It's something that we are, again, is not natural for us. We haven't had enough time in our brains for the evolution of really specialized mental processes that are devoted to reading. And so what we've done, and we'll look at the brain in a little bit, is that we use mechanisms for oral language to support our comprehension of written language, and that is really what gets us through. So again, reading is really hardwired in our brains. The letters of the alphabet, though, have no inherent meaning. And so this is also what makes reading and writing quite so difficult, is that the letters don't mean anything. So it could be a random blue squiggle all of a sudden has meaning. And that's really what we're doing with letter sounds. They look like lines and squiggles on a page without holding any meaning or purpose. And so if we look at the other shapes of different kinds of objects, for example, a baseball, it is purposely in a spherical shape. It serves the purpose of hitting the ball, of it rolling across the field, and therefore it needs to be round in order to meet the purpose of a baseball game. Cubes, they are meant to be sort of thrown or rolled, and they land with a number pattern face up. And if it was a different shape, you wouldn't be able to see the number pattern. So they are purposely in a cubic shape so that they can land in a certain pattern and in a certain way so that we can view them. Letters are not this way. So the letter T, the letter S, any other letter, someone decided that this is, you know, the design of the sound, and that's just how it is. It actually holds no inherent meaning, and so this poses a problem sometimes for young readers. So I want to spend a couple of minutes just looking at Jean Shaw's stages of reading development. Jean Shaw is a reading researcher. She developed this in the 80s, and the purpose of showing this right now is really to understand that reading really develops in a progression of stages. I don't think that the ages are necessarily so important, and I think really the goal here is to see that it's a progression, and so here's four stages, the first being pre-reading. So this is birth to age six. There's a lot of reading development that happens here. This is letter knowledge, concepts of print, environmental print. This is recognizing the big M of the McDonald's sign, recognizing the letters on a stop sign, even though young children don't actually know how to read the word stop, and they don't actually know what those sounds are made of, but they can recognize the word stop and they know what the sign says. And so that's all part of environmental print and a lot of that pre-reading that happens in those early years. After that becomes the initial reading phase, and this is the grapheme-phoneme relationship. Grapheme being the actual physical letter and the pattern, the motor pattern, and the phoneme being the sound that it's associated with. And so this is matching the letter with the sound, and that's something that's done in the initial stages of reading here. In the next stage of fluency, this is where students begin to enhance their decoding skills. They begin to develop some fluency skills. Fluency is really the combination of accuracy and automaticity and the expression or prosody that goes along with reading. And so as students develop their decoding skills, they're able to then develop more automaticity and more fluency. Many students for this phase need explicit instruction and lots of practice. Certainly not everyone, but many of them do. And then the last one that we're looking at here is the stage where they begin reading to learn. And so typically we think of, you know, those first few stages as learning to read, where the students are really focused on how to decode the words on the page, how to so-called crack the code. And then at a certain point, somewhere around third grade or fourth grade, there's a real shift. We're reading for the purpose of learning or to gain information. And that really comes later.
Naomi, someone asked if you could define prosody.
Sure. Prosody is the rhythm that reading takes on. And so prosody, for example, is where you raise your voice a little bit if you have a question, or your voice goes down a little bit at the end of a statement where there's a period. And it's that rhythm that reading takes on. Whereas expression, I would say, is the tone. Some of that could include the punctuation, but it all has to do with sort of reading smoothly. Sometimes teachers will say, it should sound like you're speaking. It should sort of be that fluid, which is hard for many students to do, but it's really a sign of being automatic in your reading and also a sign of gaining comprehension skills, because there's a strong link between fluency and comprehension. So as students understand the text, that's reflected in the way that they read and the way that their voice sounds, which in turn also then improves their comprehension. So again, here, this is about really the stages of reading development. I actually think that, this was done over 30 years ago. I think that the ages are a little bit different now. I think everything is sort of pushed down. We have a lot more pressure in schools now to start everything a little bit earlier. So I think, everything is about a year or 2 years even off, so that initial reading is sometimes taught even at age six, where students are really beginning to decode. But again, I think the understanding here that there's a flow is important. There are two more stages here that I didn't extend just because they're not really relevant for this conversation, and that happens in middle schoolers through adulthood. And that's understanding multiple viewpoints and the construction and really reconstruction of knowledge, which again continues to happen into adulthood. So again, let's talk a little bit about what the focus is tonight. What is emergent literacy, and why do we spend so much time talking about it? So very young children demonstrate the skills, they develop attitudes, and they really make meaning of text before the conventional forms of reading and writing are evident. When I say conventional forms, I'm really talking about in-school learning to read and write, so to form the letters, to spell, to decode words. That's what I'm referring to here as the conventional forms of reading and writing, but really that's all happening way before they get to school. That's happening in toddlers and in preschoolers as they're just beginning to put the pieces together. Many of these children acquire skills through exposure and encouragement as they're immersed in certain environments. I'm a really big believer in explicit instruction once students get to school, but this is something, this exposure and encouragement sort of happens a little bit more naturally, and we see that with infants and babies and preschoolers, is that they learn to love books and stories, and they begin to pick up on a lot of the skills and really can make meaning even before they get to school. Oral language is really the really critical foundation on which everything is built. And so the stronger one's oral language is, the likelihood of them being better readers is just higher. Everything has to do with the way that students produce and understand their oral language, and that's going to be highly predictive of the way that students read and understand. I love this quote by Catherine Snow. She's a renowned literacy researcher. Learning to read represents the weaving together of multiple skills, understandings, and orientations, many of which have their developmental origins in infancy and toddlerhood. So for those of you who are working with toddlers or students in pre-K, as I see from your comments, this is it. This is where it is. And so your work is critical and vital and so important. Certainly, we know that it's important for developing the social and emotional sort of parts of these young children, but it is also really critical for developing these children as readers. And that's just really all begins from such a young age. By 3 and 4 months, infants are demonstrating skills in auditory discrimination. And so what this means is that infants can actually pay attention to the sounds in the languages in which they have been exposed. So this is, infants who grow up in, let's say, English-speaking homes. By 3 and 4 months, they know that French is a foreign language. Infants who grow up in Hebrew-speaking homes, they know that English is a foreign language. And that's something that's pretty incredible, is that infants that young, obviously before they're speaking, is that they already hear that the sounds in different languages are different. And that goes back to the idea that our oral language is a natural process in our brains that we are sort of wired for, and that happens really naturally. They imitate tones and rhythms of adult talk. So sometimes, especially when infants start babbling, even before they start talking, you hear the rhythm of the way that they babble sometimes. And that comes from hearing and understanding the way that adults are babbling or talking at them. As they get a little bit older, we see that toddlers or even infants can handle and manipulate books as part of their exploration. They want to hold board books. They want to play with them. They want to explore. Often they babble as they turn pages. They babble with nonsensical sounds, and they also later they create stories for themselves once they're talking. But the way that toddlers are able to handle and manipulate books is really telling also of the type of readers that they might be, and they're starting to learn how to hold a book, how to turn the pages of a book, and that it's going to share information or tell a story. And later, young children mimic storytelling voices as they read books, and so you can see a three-year-old reading a book, which means that they're turning the pages in the correct direction, and they might be retelling a story. Obviously, they're pretend reading. They're not reading any of the words on the page, but hopefully they have listened to enough books and they understand how stories work and that pictures tell stories also. So that they mimic their storytelling voices and that they mimic sort of the look of reading. And this is really key, again, to developing those language skills. So let's spend just a couple seconds looking at the brain. I am not a neurologist, but I think that the brain is just fascinating. And there's so much that we can learn about reading and the way that kids learn to read by understanding just a little bit about how the brain functions. And it also helps us understand where then later some of the problems might arise also. So a little bit of brain geography for those who are less familiar. The brain is divided into two sort of mirror image hemispheres. And so what we're looking at right now is the left side of the brain. So it's imagine you're sort of looking at the left profile. And each hemisphere has four lobes each. The left side of the brain is often known for the speech, the language processing, and the reading side. And what this is showing here is three of the areas that are important for reading. There are a couple of others also, but these are three of the main ones. So the one at the front is Broca's area, and this is in charge of organization. This is in charge of speech production, the articulation, as you see, word analysis. This is the manipulation of language and speech and actually producing or articulating the sounds. As we move a little bit further back in the parietotemporal lobe, we are analyzing words here by pulling them apart and linking letters to sound. This is conscious, this is effortful decoding. This is where a student can, look at some letters and put together m-op, mop. And it's effortful. It really takes time and takes some effort for students. At the back is the occipitotemporal lobe or section. And this is the part of the brain that identifies words rapidly and automatically. This is where they recognize words by sight, including the letter sequence, so that C-A-T put together means cat. And then this little section of the brain right here, sorry, not the lobe, just but this part right here, is really necessary for building automaticity in reading also. So altogether, these different pieces of the brain, they really become connected to execute the act of reading and to recognize the letters C-A-T to the sounds that they make, at, and then to the word meaning. And really all of those pieces are necessary in order to create a mental orthographic image is the fancy term, but really it's to create this mental image of what the word cat looks like on a page, how to read it, how to say it, how to pronounce it, and then also to give it meaning, to know what that means. All of these different pieces of the brain are developing from when children are born. So it's not learned in school. This is developing from a very early age. So that by the time these young children reach school and by the time they're actually learning to read, their brain is really prepared to coordinate all of their language systems, so that language leads to reading and that reading leads to comprehension, and really mixing all of these pieces together to lead ideally to coordinated and effortless reading. So let's take a look at some of the most important features of this emergent reading. There was a study done in 2008 by the National Institute of Literacy, and this is from their report, Developing Early Literacy, the report on the National Early Literacy Panel. And what they found is that there are several different skills that are really necessary for later academic success in reading. And all of these skills can be built from a very early age. So the first is alphabetic knowledge. This is knowing the names and the sounds that are associated with letters. Phonological awareness, manipulating or analyzing spoken language. We'll go through that a little bit more in a minute. Rapid naming of colors and objects. So this is literally you see a series of colors or a series of random objects, and you need to rapidly name them. And then the same with letters and digits. So you see a series of letters or a series of digits, and you need to, again, how quickly can you name either the letters or the digits. The next one is writing or writing one's name. Those can be writing letters in isolation, or it could be, you know, how a child learns to first write his or her name. And then the last is phonological memory, so remembering spoken information for a short amount of time. All of these together are really skills that develop from birth up until, let's say, age five, that predict later literacy skills in school. What's interesting about all of these skills is that in the study, they maintained their predictive power even when other variables were accounted for. And so what that means is that even when they took into account IQ or socioeconomic status, even with those accounted for, these seven skills were really predictive across the board of later literacy skills in school. So what I did was I'm going to pick out a few of these so that we can go through them in a lot more detail, especially the ones that are really taught, especially in the preschool years as well. The first is alphabet knowledge, and this is knowing the names and the sounds of each letter. A letter becomes a symbol that represents a sound. So when we started off, we looked at that blue squiggle. And young children need to know that that blue squiggle doesn't represent anything. It's random. But that letter T, that is a different symbol, and that does actually represent something. That represents a sound. Moreover, each letter is a symbol, but each letter also has an uppercase and a lowercase symbol, which can sometimes make the reading and writing process that much more challenging for young children, is that they have to learn both. Some of them are obviously much easier, and some are more difficult. The next is recognition of letters and their visual features. these are the letters that stay on the writing line. These are the letters that, you know, are nice and tall, or the diver letters, or the ones that go underground. These are just different sort of nomenclature that different handwriting programs are using. But the point is that different letters have different visual features. The sequence of letters, and so the sequence in the alphabet, and also the sequence later of which letters come in which sequence to spell a word. Children often love looking at alphabet books, and this is a great way of introducing children to different sounds and different letters. Let's look at pictures that have A, let's look at pictures that have B, pictures that have C, and there's tons of terrific alphabet books out there. Using labels around the room, this is literally, you could label window, door, computer, desk, and this is not for the children to be able to read them necessarily, but this is to communicate that words have meaning, and if I write something, it's going to communicate something, and that's a lot of what you're trying to demonstrate from such an early age, is that the words have meaning to communicate. And the final one here is comparing letter shapes. And there's a lot of different ways to do that. You know, you see a picture here of a child who looks like she could be sorting letters or playing with the letters, but you can hold them also. And again, almost trace them with your finger or trace them on a piece of paper to see that all of the letters have different shapes. So you could think of some of them that, you know, one letter is shaped like a big circle, that might be the O. Another one has a circle and a line going straight down, that could be the letter P. And so these are all different aspects of alphabet knowledge, and there are different games that one can play with those, like guessing, you know, what kind of letter you're thinking of, or holding a letter shape, for example, like the one that's in this picture. And almost guessing what the letter is based on the shape. I wouldn't start there, but it's something that young children can certainly learn, and that it can be a game to play with eventually also. The next really big skill here that's quite predictive of decoding is phonological awareness, and I'm sure that most people are familiar with this as a term. This is the ability to recognize and manipulate sounds in spoken words. The reason I say spoken words is because this is really meant to be done orally. This part here is not based on reading or writing. This is something that a four-year-old could do. And this is meant to be hierarchical a little bit. So it's easier to start at the word level, at the bigger level, and then go to the syllable, and then go to the sound. So at the word level, that could be different kinds of rhyming games. That could be alliteration. Alliteration means where you have the same letter at the beginning of every word. So Sally sold seashells by the seashore. That sounds fun. That sounds funny. And that's something that 4 and 5-year-olds should be able to appreciate. And it sounds silly. And you can play different games like that. The same with rhyming. You can go back and forth, you know, wish, mish, bish, dish. Nonsense words here are fine, so it is okay to have words that aren't real words, like mish. Again, this is all about playing with language and playing with sounds. These can all, someone told me once, you know, this can be done in the dark. Again, so this is not reading or spelling. You can use words or sounds that are beyond what the child is able to read and spell, and the point is really playing with language. The next level after words is syllables. All words have syllables. Some have one syllable, some have several syllables, and each syllable must have a vowel sound, and it must have only one vowel sound. So that's the rule about syllables, but a game for this could be you clap all of the syllables in your name or different objects around the room. So I would say nay, oh, me, computer, light, door. And that's something that young children can really do also. At the smallest level, we have phonemic awareness, and this is the manipulation of individual phonemes or individual sounds, and this is really much harder. And again, it's easier to manipulate words. It's much harder to manipulate sounds. And we'll go into that in a minute also, but this is really changing different kinds of sounds and isolating them and changing them. And that's really much, much harder to hear. If we think back to the way that we co-articulate our sounds when we speak, or we sort of mush them together when we speak, that's partly what makes that phonemic awareness so difficult, is because we don't necessarily say sounds in a way that is clear to young children, sort of where the sounds start and end. And so that's something that is much harder. And again, I would progress to smaller units. So words, then syllables, onset rhyme, and then phonemes or those sounds. Onset rhyme, this is rhyme, R-I-M-E. Onset is, if you were thinking of the word, let's say, map. Sometimes I think of rhymes, R-I-M-E, as a word family. So the onset would be the m, and the rhyme here would be, what did I say, map. So that would be the app. And then that's also a different way that you can manipulate, that's bigger than a phoneme, smaller than a syllable, and sort of something in between that you can also play with here. And I would just say the last piece about phonological awareness is that I think there's a misconception that once students are in, you know, first or second grade, oh, well, then it's not worth teaching anymore. And that's really not true. Phonological awareness, it continues to develop until, you know, third, fourth, fifth, sixth grade. And so if you're teaching students in elementary school, in older elementary school, these skills are really still important, and it's worth still spending the time to do some of these activities, because some students at that level, it might be more about syllable division or individual phonemes rather than rhyming, but it is definitely still worth developing into the later elementary schools. It does not stop in first grade. So let's look more at examples of phonological awareness. Nursery rhymes are a great example of phonological awareness because it is a play on words. There's alliteration, right? Jack and Jill, they both start with the J sound. And they have a rhythm to them, and they also rhyme. So Jack and Jill went up the hill to fetch a pail of water. Jack fell down and broke his crown, and Jill came tumbling after. Again, there's a rhythm here that young students begin to recognize, begin to appreciate, and you have four-year-olds sort of smiling and enjoying these, and that is a good sign. That means that they hear the sounds and they hear that it sort of sounds fun and funny. There's a lot of children's books that are written with that in mind. So Brown Bear, Brown Bear, right? That's another example of a book. You have the alliteration there. It's very repetitive. It has that rhythm or the cadence to it. Brown Bear, Brown Bear, what do you see? Most of the Eric Carle books have that also. And so a lot of those early readers have that. And that's part of what makes reading so enjoyable for these really young children. I would say that, and we're not talking too much about this in this presentation, but some of the warning signs, you know, for four-year-olds, five-year-olds, six-year-olds who don't hear that rhyme, that's where your ears as an early childhood educator want to start to perk up and maybe test the waters a little bit with more explicit rhyming games or rhyming activities for the kids who really don't hear that Jack and Jill begin with the same sound. They're not following along the words or the repetition of a book like Brown Bear, Brown Bear, and they can't really pick up on that. That's starting to be a potential warning sign that there could be difficulty reading later on. But this is a really terrific example of phonological awareness. Let's get in a little bit more to the phonemic awareness, which is harder, and this is really, again, sound by sound individually. So what I have here is two Unifix cubes, and this is an activity that we use at my school a lot, usually with the first graders and second graders, but we can use it with older students also if they're really struggling to begin to really put sounds together. So I have two cubes here, a green one and a red one. The colors themselves don't mean anything. We chose to stay consistent with two colors. You can use two different colors, it doesn't matter. Again, this is done orally. There's no reading, there's no writing here. So an example, I might say, the word is go. What's the first sound? And they need to say g. What's the second sound? O. Put it together, go. And so what they're recognizing here is they're learning to take a word that has two sounds, g, o, and really learn to isolate those sounds. And that's something that is, again, challenging on that hierarchy of beginning with words, then going through syllables, and then ending with individual sounds. This is something that's harder for students, but that's also much more predictive of later reading ability. A different way to set those directions. So first I gave the word, that was go, and then the students identified the first sound and the last sound. The other way would be to give the sounds, and then the students need to put them together. So I'm pointing to the green and then to the red as I say b, e. What's the word? And the child says B. So again, this is two sounds that they're putting together. In the first one, they are segmenting the sounds, G, O, and in the second one, they're blending them together. And both of these are really important, and we're gonna sort of be going back and forth between segmenting and blending because they're both so important for reading and writing skills. This is an example of a three-letter sound. You can see that I added in the yellow Unifix cube here. We decided for consistency purposes with our students that the green is first, the yellow is in the middle, and the red is always the final sound. So it's not designated by vowel and consonant, it's just first, middle, last sound. And again, all of this we said explicitly to the students, we really teach them how to do this. And that takes a little while, but this is really building the phonemic awareness skills that are going to help them later for reading. So in my first example, I'm going to say cat. What's the first sound? I'm pointing to the green and they say k. What's the middle sound? Ah. What's the last sound? T. Put the word together. K, at, cat. And as they're doing it, they're pointing to green, yellow, red, so that each box or each cube is really representing a different sound in the word. Again, on the bottom, I have the reverse, so I'm giving the sounds and not the word. So now again, I'm pointing to the green, yellow, and red. I say, ah, p. What's the word? They blend it together and say, top. I think ideally every student, when you do this, if you, let's say you do this in a class, has their own set of two or three cubes. And once you do this for a while and the students pick up on the routines, you're going to reduce your language and you're just going to start pointing. So cat, and then all you have to do is point to green and they say k. So you don't even have to say what's the first sound. You're teaching them that routine to identify the sounds in the word. This is very similar to Elkhonon boxes, which some people might be familiar with. What that means is it could be, let's say, three empty boxes, and children drag tiles in to represent the different sounds of a word. It's the exact same idea. I don't think that one is better than another. For this activity, we liked it because it was a physical act of putting together and taking apart. And for some of our students, literally that concrete, you can put cubes together and then take them apart, was really helpful, that concrete visual for our students. But I think that sliding tiles into boxes really serves the same purpose if that's what you prefer. Again, you can sort of separate those cubes just for the visual. So again, I'm pointing to the colors, B, I, G, and I'm touching and saying the sounds as I go. Put them together. What's the word? Big. Again, this is all done orally. There's no reading. There's no writing here. I haven't done this with more than three sounds from my experience. I think that once kids can do this efficiently with two and three sounds, then they don't need this concrete, tangible piece anymore for putting together four sounds. And I think that then you just have a lot of cubes. There's a lot to manipulate. It can get confusing. So I think that there probably are programs that do it in different approaches. I just found that it gets to be a little bit more complicated the more sounds that you do. And what you really want to do here is build in routine and build in the ability for students to isolate those individual sounds, those phonemes in the word, and actually understand what it means to segment or to take apart sounds and then blend them together, which is so important. So here's a little bit more about these phonemic awareness tasks. The Elkhonon boxes or the cubes are great for isolating sounds, for segmenting, and for blending sounds. Here are another, I would call them tasks. I don't know, you know, they are skills. But different kinds of activities that you can ask students to do. So again, we have the alliteration piece. These are words that all have the same initial sound. So I would say, which word has a different first sound? Pig, sat, puff, pass. Again, this is oral. None of this is being done in writing. You could change the language a little bit. You could say, which one doesn't belong? Pig, sat, puff, pass. And obviously the word sat here does not belong. I don't think it matters if you use the word first or initial. Students obviously have more exposure to the word first than initial, but I think that that's certainly a teacher's choice. Phoneme isolation, this is isolating those individual sounds, kind of like we just did with the cubes. So what sound is in the beginning of the word mass? Mm-hmm. And what you really want to focus on here is that the students are saying the sound and not the letter. So if you say what sound is in the beginning of the word math and they say M, I would say what sound does that letter make? Because that's what you're really focusing on here is the sounds. And of course, you could do the middle sound or the ending sound, which here is TH, which makes the sound. Next one is phoneme segmenting. So this is segmenting sounds, much like we just did with the cubes. Tell me the sounds in the word leg. And the answer, of course, is l-e-g, leg. You could do what's the first sound, what's the middle sound, what's the final sound, but really they're breaking it apart here in sequence, which is really the key. And then again, the opposite, blending. What word do these sounds make? Sh-i-p. And you want them to say ship. And when you break it apart that way, you want them to be able to blend it back together. The last two, there's phoneme deletion. This can be really tricky. So this is, say the word stick. Now say it again without the t. The word is sick. It's much easier to take off the first sound or the last sound. So it's much easier to say the word stick. Now say it again without the and the word is tick. It's much harder to do in the middle, but that's also a much higher level skill. And notice again that what I'm doing is I'm saying the sound and not the letter name. So I didn't say take out the T or take off the S, I said the letter sound. And the last one is phoneme substitution. So say bent, now change the B to a S. What's the word? Sent. And you can do this with sounds in the middle of the word also. Say bent, change the e to an a. What's the word? Bunt. These are meant to be hierarchical. So in the same way when we looked earlier at the phonological awareness hierarchy, where the words are easier than syllables, which are easier than the individual sounds. So I would say the same for this sequence. So alliteration is, on this list, going to be the easiest. And then as it goes down further, it's going to get harder. Likewise, I would say all of these skills are really highly predictive of later reading and writing. The last two is what, like, that's the most challenging, and it's also, of course, the most predictive of later reading ability. And so students who, or young children who are able to do that, are more likely to develop stronger reading and writing skills. Kids who have difficulty in these areas, kids who can't identify sounds, kids who can't isolate them, or who have difficulty in these areas here with segmenting and blending sounds. Again, as an early childhood educator, this is where sort of your red flag warnings are going to start to go up, and you're going to want to do some, maybe some extra testing with that kid to really see what's going on. Try some rhyming, try some explicit blending and segmenting tasks like these, or like using the cubes, because it's a sign that there could be potential difficulties there down the road as they then learn to read and write. I'm wondering if anyone has used any of these. So feel free to write in the chat box if you're familiar with these, or if these are tasks that you're using in pre-K or really anywhere else that you're teaching. Sometimes these are done, I guess, in school, not done as often at home. I don't know how many people sit around the kitchen table blending sounds, but I don't know, maybe people do. The last one we're going to look at here is phonological memory. This is the ability to hold on to speech-based information in short-term memory. So you're right, we have a short-term memory, we have a working memory, a short-term memory, and a long-term memory. Long-term is what's really sticking in our brains over a long period of time. Working memory is what we need to hold on to just for a few seconds at a time. And short-term can last, you know, either a couple seconds or maybe a couple of minutes. And this is to hold speech-based information. That's the phonological piece to this memory, as opposed to remembering numbers or remembering words in a sequence. It used to be that you'd remember a telephone number, right? And you'd have to transfer it, let's say, from the phone book or the internet or something to the piece of paper, and you rehearse it. That's short-term memory. But this is really phonological. And these skills here are really critical for reading and spelling skills, because holding those sounds in sequence are really important for then how students learn to read and how to spell. Here's an interesting example. I was listening to a small class read last week, and they were working on words, like simple two-syllable words, like plastic or paper that you see here. And a child was struggling on a word, and she knew all the sounds, and she had her phonemic awareness skills were really strong. So she looked at the word, and the word was plastic, and she said, plas. Okay, she got the first syllable. Tick, paper. And it was so interesting to watch her, because it was so effortful to put together these two syllables, plastic, to make the word plastic. And at the end, she forgot what she had read. You know, she saw the P and she forgot the first part by the time she read the second part. And she sort of lost the sequence of the letters. And this is a perfect example of how phonological memory is so important, and then also why it's so important to build, because this child here really had trouble with that and didn't remember the word plastic. Another thing we want to do to teach phonological memory is we want to teach children to recognize syllables or to recognize chunks of letters. I would say that in this particular example, the child clearly knows her sounds, which is awesome. The next thing that we need to do is to teach her to recognize syllables, because that's going to be much more efficient. What I would rather her do is look at the word plastic, see that there's two parts, plastic, plastic. And that takes only two steps as opposed to all of these, you know, seven steps here to be able to sound out all of the letters in this word. It's just not efficient. And so in order to improve efficiency when reading, one way to do that is really by teaching kids to recognize syllables or other chunks of letters. For example, PL is a common blend. And so if kids can recognize pull, yeah, they say the same, you know, they each make their same sound, pull. So they're making distinct sounds, but it's something that's common. It's a very common blend that we see. Chunking whenever possible. So chunking like syllables, chunking suffixes, all of these are going to be important because we want kids to recognize ing or ed as a unit rather than individual phonemes or individual letters. It's just not going to be efficient for them when they read. So we need to teach them, we need to model, we need to practice, we need to repeat and do it over and over again. By this point here, I'm talking about actual reading and writing on a piece of paper. So this is not done orally as much, but it's sort of reliant on those early skills. I'm going to skip ahead just a little bit. This is the decoding piece that really puts together the phonemic awareness so that students are able to read. Multisensory teaching is found to be a very helpful tool when actually teaching students how to read and write. It is much easier to integrate multiple sources of information when you present it simultaneously as opposed to just one modality. I often think of this, you know, for anyone who works out a little bit, you know, would you rather spend your time or is it better for your body to do a whole set of bicep curls and then a bunch of squats, or is it better for your body to do them simultaneously? And the answer is simultaneously. It's not as, you know, it's obviously much harder, and I'm not saying we all are doing it, but if we think actually about what's better for our bodies, it's better to do them simultaneously. And so the same thing is true when building reading and writing skills also. And of course, it also just improves overall engagement. I want to say something here about reversals, because I think this is so common here, especially for early childhood educators. Kids write letters backwards. That is not dyslexia. That is highly developmental. It is kids sort of misnaming letters, letter sounds or letter names. It's not that they're seeing the letters backwards. It's that the spellings of words are not actually firmly established in their brains, and is very sort of normal and natural for young children. We can see an example of that. We are taught from a very young age, we're sort of biologically wired even, for this invariant object recognition. And that means if we see this red chair, we can flip it upside down, we can look at it in any way we want to, it's still going to be a chair. We can look at a hammer in any different direction, it's still going to be a hammer. And we're wired to see these objects as such. So that objects are the same regardless of the direction that they're facing. And then all of a sudden kids get to school and they're told that that letter B, when you flip it around, can actually become any of four letters and that they all look pretty much identical when you flip it around. That's something that actually has to be suppressed for reading and writing in order to be an effective reader, an effective writer. You need to be able to suppress that piece that we're really wired for. And so this is challenging. And for some kids, it takes them longer and their brains haven't learned that difference and that the difference in the orientation actually matters here. And of course, that can happen reversals in words also. The last piece here is about reading aloud to children. We have tons and tons of research to show that reading aloud is so beneficial and that it's really the interactive style of reading that's so important. So the parent talking to the child or the teacher talking while reading, it's not just looking at the words or looking at the pictures, it's actually the conversation that happens as well. It accelerates language development, and later, of course, leads to educational achievement. Kids have a short attention span, so, you know, read for a short amount of time, but read often. I'm not going to go through all of these, but this is something in my research, a list of 13 things that babies learn when we read to them. I cannot take credit for it, but I just love it because there's pieces on this list that speak to the emotional connection, that speak to learning, that speak to understanding of books, exploration, cause and effect. And so please do take a look at those because I think that they're terrific. Vocabulary development is so key, and this begins really when kids are toddlers and young children also. There was a very big study done in 1995 by Hart and Risley. They conducted a really seminal and longitudinal research study that examined the way that parents talk to children and the number of words that they use with their children. And what they found was major, major differences between the vocabularies and language abilities of children who grow up in language immersive environments, as opposed to children who grow up in families that don't talk to their children as much. And that by the time children enter school, there could be a 30 million word gap between these different students. And so speak to your children, speak to them often, and that is just so necessary for building later reading skills. They need to be able to understand what they're reading. And a summary of some of the pieces that we've talked about tonight. I know we sort of, I ran through the end a little bit quickly, but I think the keys here are that for really young students, for young children, for infants, for toddlers, for preschoolers, the interactive read aloud is really important in building a love of books, an understanding of story elements, and that really lay the groundwork and foundation for them to become readers as they grow up. Sing and read nursery rhymes, play with words, play rhyming games, play phonological awareness games, clap the syllables, take turns rhyming in the car. I spy initial sounds. I see an object outside that starts with the sound and it's really tall. Oh, it's a tree. And so there's all kinds of games to play that, again, just play with sounds and words. You can build words through writing or through manipulating letters. This can be done orally, or this can be done reading. And putting together all of these different skills and all these different pieces, really all of this leads to better outcomes for children to learn to read and write when they get to school, that really begin in infancy and toddlerhood. So thank you, everyone. Again, I know I ran through the end.
Oh, thank you so much, Naomi. If you could just shift the controls back over to me, that would be great. If you're okay, I have a couple questions in the audience.
Please, go ahead.
All right, if you could just drag the control ball back to the top item on the screen. It's the top hidden spark. Hopefully you can do that. Anyway, in the meantime, you know what, Eitan, you want to just grab it from Naomi and flip it to the next slide? Okay, in terms of alphabet knowledge, would you recommend teaching letters by shape or visual features, like in that type of an order rather than an ABC order?
Yeah, I would do it based on visual shape and motor pattern. I think that the kids and toddlers often learn the ABCs. It's a catchy tune, and it's something that they learn by rote, which is fine and great. But in terms of actually teaching sounds and the way to write letters, I would do it based on motor patterns. So I would do, C, A, D, G. I would do all of those letters first, which is often what some handwriting programs do anyway, PAF or handwriting without tears. They have different words for them, but I would do those first, and then the tall letters, and then sort of those either diver or sort of letters that go underground, that go down.
And then in terms of capitals and lowercases, do you treat them as pairs, like, and teach them kind of as pairs or in a different type of order?
It's a great question. I would do it separately. I think that, some people will say that, little hands and little fingers in toddlers and preschoolers, that it's much easier to draw straight lines, so capital letters, than it is to do lowercase letters. But lowercase letters are a lot more useful. And so I would spend the time actually doing lowercase letters. And you can practice that again in preschool years by drawing shapes, drawing circles, drawing squares, doing mazes, and a lot of those fine motor skills then later prepare kids for the fine motor tasks of writing.
Okay, great. And then our last question was, when you use those Unifix cubes for the phonemic awareness, because I noticed you had the blank cubes, would you recommend using a blank cube rather than a cube with the letter on it, if you're focusing on the phonemic element?
I would use them blank. Yeah, I wouldn't use the letter, the visual grapheme, because I think that that can be distracting. And at this level, the kids don't know how to read them. And so it's much more important that they're able to orally blend and segment them together as opposed to actually reading. They need to orally blend them first before they have any idea what they're reading and spelling.